This edition of the week is sponsored by Invitrogen. Gibco Cell Culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.
Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and welcome to a special edition of The Week, the weekly news podcast from The Scientist. In this podcast, we'll be giving you an exclusive preview of some of the stories that will be appearing in the March issue of The Scientist. The issue contains stories such as a controversial theory that could unite all of biology and a guide to the growing number of non-retraction retractions appearing in journals. We'll be joined by Richard Gallagher, The Scientist's editor-in-chief, and deputy editor Ivan Aransky. They'll take us behind the scenes of these and other stories in the upcoming issue.
Every time I hear about this work, it still gives me butterflies in my stomach.
That's Richard Gallagher, The Scientist's editor-in-chief. We'll find out which story made him feel this way later on. But before that, we've been following California's initiative to fund stem cell research for some time now. Our news editor, Allison McCook, has an update on our website that the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine has approved $45 million in grants for human embryonic stem cell research. Allison writes that the organization remains tied up in never-ending lawsuits, so the money comes from a $150 million loan from the state's general fund. Another 25 grants, totaling $80 million, is slated to be distributed in March. Next up, our senior editor Brendan Marr attended the Keystone Conference in New Mexico called Reproduction Advances and Challenges. I checked in with him about halfway through to see what was happening.
It's really interesting, Carrie. This is the first time that they've ever held this meeting. The organizers, Susan Fisher, S.K. Day, and Mike Roberts, they've done a good job of really bringing together kind of disparate fields that all approach reproduction from one direction or another. So you have a really rich kind of pastiche of different fields of research, going from cell molecule to endocrinology to immunology, and they're all looking at what are some of the things that happen during ovulation, during spermatogenesis, and then when the egg and cell meet, then even going on to when the embryo implants on the side, and really looking at just a wide range of issues that are important at a basic science level, but also at a clinical level.
What were some of the talks that really caught your interest?
Well, I'd say there was one that I really liked. There's several that I really liked, actually. But the one that kind of stuck out in my mind, mostly because I think there's going to be some interesting clinical implications for it, was Daniel Carson from the University of Delaware. He was presenting on MUC1, which, as you might know, is a cell surface marker. It's a big, ugly one, too. It juts out from the cell a lot further than most other cell markers or cell receptors, and it seems to be acting in kind of like a lubricant. It blocks access to the uterine wall from the embryo. So this, and mammals, different mammals actually have kind of various ways of dealing with this, of getting rid of it so that the embryo can implant. And what he found was that there are certain, he was looking for some of the signals that drive this down in humans, and one of the signals he found kind of traces back to a protein called PIAS. There's actually a family of them, but PISY in particular looked like it would be an interesting target for kind of reducing the MUC1 signal all over the uterine wall and allowing cells to implant. So this might be kind of considered a target for treating infertility, although it's unclear whether MUC1 is actually a problem in most kinds of infertility, but maybe used in conjunction with something like IVF, it would make the implantation process take a lot easier.
That's really fascinating. And I also know, as you mentioned, Mike Roberts from the University of Missouri is one of the conference organizers, and we had some news reports about him lately and some potential misconduct that might have gone on in his lab regarding a science paper that came out in 2006. I should say Dr. Roberts has been exonerated from the investigation. I know there were some talks about what Roberts' study in science was on and whether two cell stage blastomeres show evidence of distinct cell lineages, and I'm interested to hear what you were able to listen to there.
Yeah, I spoke with Roberts briefly, and he pretty much reiterated what he had said in your story, that it looked pretty likely the paper was going to be retracted in time, although I'm not really sure what the delay is. There was a talk by Davers Salter, who, very much in opposition to the findings from that Roberts paper, showed that really there is no kind of cytoplasmic localization of factors that would drive one cell in the two-cell stage to go to one lineage versus another, and that it was much more a stochastic process. He had some interesting computer models and just some great video shown throughout his presentation that really backed up this claim. It really fit the model that it was just largely a random process.
That was our senior editor, Brendan Marr, checking in from the Keystone Conference in New Mexico, Reproduction, Advances, and Challenges. Next, they say that behind every great story are a dozen more. We'll now look at the stories that will be appearing in the March issue of The Scientist.
Hi, this is Ivan Oransky, deputy editor of The Scientist.
And Richard Gallagher, the editor of The Scientist. Hello.
We're here this week on the podcast to talk about our March issue, talk about some of the features, and want to give you a preview of that issue, which some of you may have already seen, either in print or online at our website, www.the-scientist.com. One of the features in our issue this month is about two biologists and a physicist who get together regularly in Santa Fe, and they've come up with something that others, and I'll sort of be careful here to say that they're very careful about what they call it, are calling the grand unifying theory of biology. It's a very interesting theory. Richard and I are going to talk about it a little bit, but Richard, you have a little bit of insight into this, a little bit of your own knowledge that others might not have. Tell me about that.
Well, every time I hear about this work, it still gives me butterflies in my stomach because I was the manuscript editor that handled the initial and rather controversial submission of this paper.
And this was 10 years ago now,
yeah,
1997.
Yeah, I was at Science, and I was the newly minted ecology editor. This was, I guess, the first real landmark sort of paper that I handled or mishandled. Handled, I think. And it was very controversial, both through the Science has a two-stage review process. The board of reviewing editors look at something, and if they're sufficiently positive and the staff editor is sufficiently positive, it goes for peer review. This paper actually was very divisive, even at the board of reviewing editor level, one very positive, one very negative. I talked to my colleagues and we reviewed it. The first two reviews came in very positive, thought of as a landmark theoretical contribution. But the third reviewer, who was an expert in hydrodynamics, really did not like the paper, raised serious issues. Unfortunately, that reviewer refused to look at a second version of it because he thought that he had made his decision and that was it. But I did get the authors to respond and sent it out to two further reviewers in hydrodynamics.
Tell me, how typical is that, that someone will actually refuse to respond?
That's rather atypical, but I think when it's a paper that's as polarizing as this, you can look at it and you can say, this is really trivial and I don't want to waste my time on it. And there was really no middle ground here. People either looked at it and said, we've got, as you said, a grand unifying theory here, or they looked at it and they said, this is very self-evident, and or this is so wrong that we don't even want to be bothered with it.
So to fast forward a little bit, you did end up publishing the paper. It did appear in 1997.
It appeared in 1997 amid, calls for my head, calls for the author's head on the one hand, and also a great appreciation of their work. No great appreciation of mine right now.
Well, that, of course, is how we editors have to live.
Yeah,
but
it's the vicarious thrill of being associated with something that is really one of the main things about being a manuscript editor. You feel as if you're a witness at the scene of something, especially in a big paper like this. It happened for me, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, but you really feel as if you're involved in being the first to know about a great new scientific insight, and there's a real buzz about it.
Well, let's talk actually about, we've sort of given you the history now, but what does the paper really say? I mean, what's the basic idea here?
So basically, it's explaining the three-quarter power laws in biology, and that is that a large number of biological characteristics scale to the three-quarter power. It wasn't clear why that was up until this point. And what these three chaps did, West, Brown, and Enquist, they invoked features of fractal geometry combined with hydrodynamics of resource supply to be able to not only explain data, but also to make predictions about what they would find in systems that hadn't been studied yet, to considerable effect.
And the paper has certainly garnered a lot of citations, somewhere over 700, I think, is the number right now.
When we checked.
Not all of them, of course, as our readers will know, not all of them have been necessarily positive. Just because a paper is cited doesn't mean that it's sort of cited as evidence for something, maybe cited as evidence against something or questioned in some way. And we'll let you read more about the paper and about how it came together, because it's really a very interesting story about why two biologists and a physicist would even be hanging out in Santa Fe, New Mexico, other than the obvious sort of lovely scenery. Our reporter actually went out there. Bob Grant went out there for and spent a couple days with the gang, and his report is really quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, interesting in that it now extends even into the social sciences. When they look at some aspects of energy supply and other metrics of cities, they find that they can make these predictive assessments of different aspects of traffic patterns and so on and so forth. Going back to the peer review process, Ivan, you commissioned a feature for the March issue, looking at the wide range of ways in which journals make comment, cautionary comment about articles that they've published. Do you want to talk a wee bit about that?
Yeah, this was something I've been running around in my brain for probably a couple of years now. I've been following, as I'm sure you all have, a lot of the retractions that are occurring, corrections. Retractions and corrections are pretty straightforward, but I started seeing some things that I wasn't familiar with, and although I didn't have Richard's experience in terms of peer review and manuscript editing, I have worked at a couple of different journals, JAMA in particular, and sat in on a lot of manuscript meetings, and I'd never heard some of these terms. Expression of concern, there's actually an expression of concern reaffirmed, sort of the second time, once the authors had responded to the first expression of concern, and many of you will remember that happened in the New England Journal of Medicine around the Vioxx study, the Vigor study that came out, and now is, of course, questioned so much now that Vioxx has been withdrawn from the U.S. market. And so I thought it would be a good idea to actually take a look at some of these things, and what we did was create a glossary. Our intern, Andrea Garaleski, wrote this piece, and she scoured the literature, talked to a lot of editors about what they're doing, talked to the International Council of Medical Journal Editors about some changes they've made. And I think it's a
very interesting
piece.
All these terms? Do you detect the icy hand of legal advice at work here?
Well, on the advice of our lawyers here at The Scientist, I'm not supposed to answer that question. But no, in all seriousness, that very well could be part of it. I think certainly there is perhaps a reluctance to come down as hard on some authors. But I think that, to be fair, there's also a little bit more skittishness on the part of some of the authors themselves. And one of the things that Andrea uncovered was that authors seem to be a little less willing to actually come forward and have a paper retracted. Because as you know, Richard, you do need the author's consent to formally retract a paper.
Yeah.
You can do things like expression of concern without that. Or there's actually something called an editor's warning now, which I find interesting.
So how many different categories did you come up with, and are they widely shared across different journals, or journals are just coming up with their own categorizations?
Well, there are about 12, I want to say. She came up with about 10 or 12, and actually there are more than that because some of them share names or they have sort of extensions on names. But there's actually a formal code. So the ICMJE actually has a formal code on this, and these types of things have to fit into their rubric somehow. And so they're titled different things, and they have specific meanings, and that's why the glossary we thought would be particularly helpful. But there does seem to be more happening in terms of new kinds of ways to do this. I mean, it's not really a retraction, but one of the things that sparked my interest was a story that one of our news reporters did a couple years ago, where someone whose study was actually rejected through peer review, proper peer review, by an environmental journal, actually decided that the paper was so important that he would publish this study as an ad in that journal.
The whole question of paying to publish your article, and it strikes me as fundamentally a total waste of time and money. It's not going to have a citation reference. It's an advert, so you'll get that one-time read through of people. You can't cite it yourself, even not honestly. It just seems to me to be an absurd move. Also, I mean, I'd quite like to ask you, what would be your attitude as an editor to publishing somebody's piece? I mean, let's say someone wanted to publish a news piece in our magazine and were prepared to give us a nice big check and publish it as an advert. Would you turn a blind eye?
I actually would, I think. And then maybe that's, you know, sort of my role now as what I think of as a sort of hardcore journalist rather than journal editor. If it says advertisement on it, doesn't really bother me what it says. I mean, there are obvious exceptions, particularly slanderous or libelous claims. But if it says advertisement, I don't know, you know, how that would necessarily be different.
Of course, we do have that issue on the web. Anybody that runs Google Ads on the web, you've got essentially no control over what's going to pop up there. And, you know, a good example was the paper that we ran in January about the Mueller research, and there were some pretty crazy Google ads came up there.
Some very strange things came up, actually. Investigative services actually saved that email. I'll have to find it, maybe for next time. Well, speaking of peer review, Richard, going back to that for a second, one of the things that's been interesting you and I have been talking around the office a little bit about this issue is just all of that correspondence, and I know that you actually took a look at the correspondence when you were thinking about this power laws piece, about the ecology piece, all that correspondence between editors and reviewers and authors. I know you have some concerns about the confidentiality of that information.
Well, I was lucky enough to get all the correspondence from the authors of the paper that I handled. I didn't get it through the journal. Science Magazine, like every other journal that I've spoken to, it completely holds all peer review material completely in confidence and won't let it available to anyone. What I would like to suggest is that after a period of time, be it 5 years or 10 years, all these manuscript files become open to anyone who wants to go in and read them, because we're missing a lot of scientific history here. In another 5 years, wouldn't it be very interesting to be able to go in and look at the review process and the exchanges over the publication of the draft genome sequence? I think there's quite a lot of juicy material in there that people would be interested in reading. And that's only the most obvious case. There's probably, I don't know, a dozen papers each year where you would learn a lot about science, about the processes of science, about individuals involved in making science through being able to access these files. But, of course, the journals aren't currently making them available. And I'm going to float the idea that we should be making these available.
Well, you've just floated it here for our podcast listeners, and we'll have to leave it confidential beyond that for now, but it'll be in our April issue. Richard's going to make some sort of proposals about that. Thanks all for listening. Again, I'm Ivan Oransky.
And Richard Gallagher.
Go to our website to read the features, editorials, and web extras from the March issue. You can also read the latest from our Culture Friday series. In this week's article, read what happens when our contributor, Melinda Winner, takes an evolutionary biologist to a digital zoo in New York. You can also lend us your thoughts, read the editor's blogs, and keep up to date with the Scientist Daily News. That's all from the Scientist Podcast this week. Thanks for tuning in.
This edition of The Week was brought to you by Invitrogen. Gibco cell culture products now feature easy-to-read, color-coded, and writable labels that are easy to find. Take a closer look at www.invitrogen.com/labels.